If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today.
Chrissy Juno Mann is a UK-based embroidery practitioner and teacher who came third in the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Embroidery Prize hand embroidery category with a fantastic blackwork portrait called Ayana. I've never met Chrissy before, and our conversation starts out with her discussing how she runs 3-hour online classes. And at first, as you'll hear, I ask her, you know, what does she fill the time with? But before long, it became abundantly clear that Chrissy not only is a world-class embroiderer, but she's also an exemplary raconteur. We have so much fun. Some of the stuff that she talks about, the life that she's had, her philosophy towards needlework, it's just fantastic. I enjoyed talking with Chrissy so much, I could have talked to her for another 3 hours, and I really would encourage you to go and visit Cloud Juno, her website, to see her work. Chrissy trained at the Royal School of Needlework in the Future Tutor program and has fantastic skills. And what's great is that if you're interested, you can sign up to her newsletter and learn from her yourself. So I would completely encourage you to do that. Thanks for being part of this Needle Exchange episode. The second part of Chrissy's interview will come along next week. And thank you for the lovely feedback we've been getting on our social media. It's great to hear that you're enjoying the show and that my new normal format is appealing to you. Anyway, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy this. Chrissy's great. I think you're going to enjoy this one a lot. So dive on in and I'll be back next week with the second part.
Well, I do chat on Zoom. I do 5-hour sessions on Zoom.
5-hour sessions?
Who'd have thought I can talk for 5 hours?
That's like the sort of thing that they do on home shopping channels, right?
I don't know. I don't really watch them, but yeah, they do. I mean, it's just a day class on Zoom, isn't it? That's what I do, you know. So, and, you know, you think at the beginning, I mean, God, I didn't even know Zoom existed before COVID. And I thought, well, you know, oh my God, 5 hours. But then it turns out, yeah, I'm quite good, because sometimes you get a, you know, a tough crowd. Sometimes the audience is, you know, active, and sometimes a little bit more challenging to get them, draw them in. I mean, I'm quite good at that, but you know, when it is a
I mean, tell me about that, because obviously I've done workshops and stuff in the past, and it's, for me, a cross stitch workshop is, you know, the learning curve for cross stitch on average about 7 minutes. It's not exactly the most technical one, but I mean, what kind of workshops are you doing? How do you structure them? And then, yeah, what do you talk about for like 5 hours?
Well, I mean, I suppose I do a day class, which can be, you know, a kit, a small kit. So realistically, I think about 6 stitches is sort of the going. You can maybe squeeze an 8 if it's like a little French knot or something, but, you know, about 6 stitches. You get 3 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon. And because you've got a visualizer, which are just sort of game-changing, the visualizers just allow you to get up so close and project it back onto the screen. And, you know, and also people can send in images and I can project them back onto the screen so you can get a real close-up look at what people are doing. So those are the classes, really, just doing a general, just like going to a workshop in person, but it's from the comfort of your own home. But then, you know, the chatter is, you know, just anything, really. I mean, you know, I might look at you and go, oh, what's that picture behind you? You know, I love that. What is it? Oh, what a wall, a shape, you know. So, you know, I force people to get drawn in and I sort of go around and ask them things.
It's almost like you're the sort of compere of a show in some ways, isn't it? It's the same thing. I know what you mean, because there comes a point when the tuition ends and it's just a practice, isn't it? And I guess here it's just what a set period of time where people are learning the one stitch you've taught them to really bed it in. But yeah. Then you do, you know, like I'm trying to think what the, oh, it'd be like Cilla Black almost, you know, like what's your name? Where'd you come from? You know, almost have to switch into that kind of mode, don't you? Just being a bit like,
that intro does always happen, and you have to sort of, and sometimes people want to go off on one and you have to try and narrow it down because we really need to start the day. But then, you know, once everyone's involved, and also you get a lot of repeat customers. I mean, I do. I'm really fortunate like that. And so people go, oh, I recognize you from another class. And so you do get interaction between, you know, it's, I think some people think that it's just, I mean, I went on somebody else's Zoom class, not embroidery, it was felting, just to see, and it was so quiet, nobody talked, the tutor didn't interact, it was kind of boring. So, yeah, I'm definitely not like that. It's more than a compere, it's more like a ringmaster at a circus.
It's almost like being a DJ as well, isn't it? You have a responsibility to maintain the mood of the space. Yeah. I always, like when I would do workshops, I'd want to have music on for that very reason as well, to just channel the right kind of vibes into it.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, they just wouldn't hear the music over my chatting, to be honest. True. I did have one woman, and this is quite funny. I mean, you always get really, you know, nice people generally. I've always had nice people. But there was one woman, I was doing a Jane Austen workshop, actually, and it was like a little button. And at the end of the day, I sort of go, oh, how did it go? You know, let's have a look at what you've done. And she wasn't a well woman, and she basically just looked at the screen and went, I've managed to make a cow pat with a pearl on it. I was like, well, that is the quote of the day. Anyway, you go from that. Really. But everyone else is just like, ah. I mean, it was just funny.
Can you think of like the top three questions that you always get asked?
Not really. I mean, gosh, the one that I can tell you, the thing I don't miss from doing workshops is I don't get asked to thread people's needles anymore. When I'm in person in a workshop, I literally have to have my pedometer on for the time I go around a table threading people's needles. So at least now I can sit there and go, oh, fortunately, I can't help you with that.
I remember once doing a cross-stitch workshop for like 8, 9, and 10-year-olds, and literally that was all I was doing the whole time, just threading. There'd be two kids that got it and went off with it, and the rest of them, they'd just be holding back the tears.
Yeah, I know. It is practice gets perfect. But I suppose that is the number one. How do you thread the needle? You know, and I try and show them, you know, little tricks to try and get it through. But otherwise, it really depends on the project, because my projects vary quite a lot, I think. You know, I might do gold work, or I might do designing for black work or Jacobean, or I might just do a little Jacobean kit. So I do quite a few different techniques. So, you know, there's a bit of variety, which is good.
Mm. Right. So let's start at the beginning then, because, well, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you on the third place in the hand embroidery, the Mr. Ipswich Hand Embroidery Prize, with a stunning black work piece. I was so pleased. Do you know why I was pleased? Is I remember it must have been like maybe 15 years ago now, I went to the NEC. I was fairly early in Mr. Ipswich zone or whatever. And I saw on the RSN stand, I saw a portrait of a horse that had been done in black work.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the first time that I'd seen that black work could create that sense of surface and depth and texture, you know, just through the variety of the stitches. And ever since then, I've always been a fan of black work. But in some ways, I've also then been a little bit critical, if you like, because I see a lot of people doing black work, but then never feels like they're unleashing it properly. And then when you produced, you know, that piece that you entered, it was just like, here we go.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's sort of a little bit surface and they need to get a little bit more depth into it, don't they? I think that's to do with tonal shading, the tonal values across the piece, really. I think people sort of struggle to choose the right image sometimes to start with. I'm not a believer that all images work for everything. And, you know, and I think also it's about getting that, you know, getting that depth. I wanted to try and, I mean, sometimes a piece takes on a life of its own and it just reveals itself. And in some ways, you know, that was, you know, with this particular piece. But at the same time, there are processes that you can do. And that's what I try and teach my students. So I sort of developed a sort of technique that I call tonal mapping. And I did use it for this, where, you know, there are so many sort of shades, really, of black, you know, tones going across that I needed to be, you know, it ends up being a little bit like stitching by numbers, where you kind of have a complex map that you can then follow with the stitching. But it is fairly easy process to put together. You sort of build it up in layers. So that's how I sort of manage that, really. But really, I suppose black work's a weird one for me, because I'm very much think I'm known more for colour. But with black, you have to get down to that nitty-gritty, don't you, of that sort of, you know, that depth, and to try and pull out a bit of a personality. And that sounds weird, doesn't it? Because it's like a 2D thing. But, yeah, I wanted to draw out some sort of, you know, so she didn't look just like a embroidery. She looked like she had a soul.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. It's like there are so many embroidery types and there are so many things that you can do to create depth and texture, but I think there's something about the repetition of the pattern and the density of the stitches in black work that really offers it. Like, it's such a great one for those kind of, and often like optical illusion type things as well, because I guess basically that's what it is, isn't it? You're just creating an optical illusion.
Yeah.
But it's like, when you see it done really effectively, it's just sublime.
Yeah, I think, well, thanks, if you're referring to my one.
I am.
I mean, I started it actually ages ago, and then I sort of abandoned it for a while because life things got in the way and too much work. I was trying to do too much work, because it was more of a personal piece. I sort of had two different sides to me. I have my personal work and then I have my commercial work, where I try and earn a living, really. And so she falls into my personal work. And then I picked her up again because it was so near finished that I just thought, I've just got to finish it. And then it all sort of got wrapped up with the fact that my mother was, you know, she's moved into a dementia home and she wasn't given that long to live. She's actually still alive and fine. She's improved. But at the time, it was sort of, and I just needed to be there. And it was just really difficult to sit and do nothing and just watch this, you know. So I set up my little studio sort of there and I stitched her there. So I do feel very attached to her, because I feel like a lot of emotion around the time has gone into the picture as well. I really focused. I just sat for hours, you know, doing every little detail, because I literally was sitting for hours with someone, and, you know, I was filling that time. I feel like it's imbued for me with that, you know, with that emotional side. You know, it will always be a marker of something that's happened in my life. And I quite like that with embroidery. You know, I think my personal work does reflect that in some way, even though it's super subtle and nobody would really know. But I think that, you know, I just had the time to put that extra depth into it, because I stopped a lot of other things to spend the time with my mum, really. So when people are under time pressure, you know, like if you're, they do, you know, black work at the RSN, you know, they have so many days to do it in, and so there's only so much you can maybe do, and maybe you do need a double amount of time to really give it that extra depth. So sometimes that is a limitation that is on people, I think.
Yeah. Is there a proportion you would say between, like, because it's nice you're able to do your own personal work. I think there's always a tension, isn't there, when you do something for a living about the amount you have to do to bring the dollars in and the amount you can do for yourself. How is that balance for you?
Not brilliantly, I'd say. I would like to get a better balance, but I do get frustrated if I don't find time to do my own thing because, you know, fundamentally the kids are not me at my optimum. You know, they're slightly simpler because, you know, I'm trying to sell them to a wider audience. So I really enjoy stitching them. I try and they're not that beginnerish. They're sort of intermediate to slightly advanced. And, you know, I do, and they're quite cute often. They're quite sort of animal based and they're quite, you know, nice colors or whatever, but appealing. But the other, you know, the yin and yang is that, you know, I've got the other side where I want to do the personal work, which is maybe something me processing emotionally or something that's occurred or something I just want to do for the sheer hell of doing it. And I do struggle to find that time, but I feel going forward that is something I want to find more of. Because I think it's important as well to keep my skills up, otherwise I'll plateau. And also just to find my voice. I feel like I'm still finding my voice. You know, I know a lot of people you have on your needle exchange are exhibiting artists. I'm not one of those. And I feel like I'm nowhere near that, I feel. But, you know, I feel like, and I'm not sure I want to be because of the pressure associated with that, but I'd like to keep working towards, you know, improving and producing something that I'm quite proud of. So I think it's important.
Yeah, because that's the interesting thing, isn't it? You're technically excellent and you're able to teach lots of people, but in the same way as sort of the art versus design thing, you know, design is made for lots of people but isn't necessarily a personal expression of your soul. I guess you're taking steps down that path, but you're not able to do it at the pace you'd like to.
Yeah, I can't focus 100% on it. But I do think some of the sort of more fun things are part of my, you know, personality and journey, because we are made up of so many elements, aren't we? But, you know, for example, I've done this sort of death figure, and that was after my father died. You know, I sort of produced that as a sort of marker, you know, to sort of process all of that. And, you know, and actually I think he's a rather handsome chap who was kind of inspired by the catacombs, you know, the Italian mummified, I mean, they're so freaky, but, you know, I feel quite a warmth towards him. But again, it's like a little marker of something that happened in time for me. But for anyone else, they might just go, why have you done that? It's so weird.
But I think that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's, you know, you're almost using it as a personal documentary, a way of just identifying moments in time. And the question is, do you choose to flip that and make it a public documentary? Because I'm sure there are loads of people who do this and they don't ever think, I'm going to exhibit this work.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes they can feel so random when seen individually. You know, it is a random piece. But, you know, over a course of, you know, many pieces, you could see threads going forward. And I think that, you know, that with a lot of things, you know, it's, you know, it is a language, isn't it? I really love language. Anyway, I quite like the writing side of things as well. And, you know, and visually this is a language. It's my language. You know, it's how I'm choosing to express myself. It hasn't got a, you know, so many people fall upon a style and stick with it, don't they? I don't really do that. I would find that a wee bit boring. And I don't really need to because I can do lots of different styles. So I quite like, I've sort of ditched the ones I'm not so keen on, you know, I've kind of gone, okay, I'll leave that. But I quite like combining, you know, the styles as well, sort of a mashup, as I'd say. But because that makes it fun. That makes it fun and stimulating and exciting to stitch. And if you get bored with one little section, you can go, you know what, I'm going to do that over there now. And that's nice. You know, so I do quite like mixing it up quite a lot. But yeah, it is. I think everyone does have language. We might not see it all the time, but that, you know, within people's choices, that things come through. You know, a friend of mine, she always stitches hairs because she loves hairs. You know, people have repeat motifs that they go to all the time, you know, and then you have to say, why do you stitch hairs, you know, and sort of ask that question.
To that point, I've got a question for you then. Why do you stitch dead birds?
The cat. Well,
is that what it is? Yeah.
Well, I know people do say, do you seem to have a lot of dead stuff in my work? And I do have a lot of dead around me a lot of the time. So, you know, I do have quite a wild cat. He's part Bengal, who's out in the forest. I feel like I'm a guardian angel of mice. In fact, I probably look a bit knackered tonight because we had a live mouse under the bed last night. But then I go under and save it, and I realise there was half an eaten mouse, you know. So I'm there all the time, but I've had him for nearly 10 years, and when he was younger, there was like three, sometimes four mice a day, you know, three during the night. It was a nightmare. So I've saved loads of them, thousands of mice. But, you know, fortunately, the birds don't get caught quite so much, but some do. And they are so beautiful, alive or dead. I think the creatures are beautiful. And therefore, I often photograph them. You know, I give the mice a little CPR if they just sort of, you know, just sit.
Tiny little rub.
Yeah, I do my little thumb. So I think it's, I think it's that. It's like I don't want to waste this beautiful creature. And, you know, you don't get up close to animals like, I don't know, blackbirds or robins or something like that. And therefore, you know, to be able to photograph it is actually quite a privilege. So then I don't want to waste that. So I try and turn it into something. Plus, I also really love, you know, the canvas stitching that I use. That for me, it's like oil painting. So I feel like canvas is like oil painting. You know, you can get the same sort of depth of texture and, you know, it has that resonance to it. And it can be really beautiful. So I think it sort of ends up looking like an old master. I might be slightly inflating it there.
No. I think you're right. I absolutely love them. I think so there's a couple of things here. One is I'm a cat lover, and we've had cats in the past, and I can remember in the past, like, waking up in the morning and finding, because we lived in the countryside, finding bits of rabbit on the landing, just like an ear or something, and knowing that there might have been a baby rabbit at one point, you know. They're such killing machines. And wasn't there some stat that, like, cats kill like 6 billion birds a year or something ridiculous, you know, worldwide. But at the same time, like, one of the things that I always love in this context is you have these very traditional forms of needlework, and you in particular deliver them with excellence, but there's always the risk of, you know, crewel work being Jacobean, canvas work having this certain approach or whatever. So then when you're choosing to make, like, immortalize dead birds, it's such a modern school of thought that I absolutely love it, because then it's being applied to this traditional thing, and then it completely dismantles the way people feel about that canvas work in the first place.
Yeah, I feel like canvas is, it's been around for so long, you know, from way, way back, and, you know, it's had such a journey, you know, to now that it's a lot of pop art type canvases around. But, you know, it's also falling into a bit of a trap, I feel sometimes, of going into a bit of, you know, photorealism. You see a lot of, you know, of that style. And for me, that doesn't work particularly well. I don't think canvas, unless you're doing it like maybe the dead bird type thing, but, you know, when you do lots of different stitches, there's that potential to be so exciting and to be like, I think it's like pointillism or expressionism or even impressionism, you know, those kind of things. It's like the Van Gogh, you know. You don't have to. Oh, you know, like Hockney, he paints a tree blue. You know, a tree doesn't have be green, the sky does not have to be blue. You know, when you look at Van Gogh's work, there's so much colour in the sky, there's beautiful peppermint colours, and then they're reflected in the cornfield or whatever, you know, tints of it here and there, or in the man's jacket. And, you know, there's sort of, it kind of flows, there's a balance to it. And I often see canvas works as that sort of photorealism, you know, the grass is green and the sky is blue, and it's sort of, you know, where's the merging of the colour? I feel in a way it is like pointillism, where it's like, you know, little spots of colours. It's like alchemy, isn't it? You know, where you put several spots into a needle and you pull it through, and, you know, who knows which one will land first? And yes, you can manipulate it, but actually it's quite nice not to, and to let the magic happen, to let it fall in its own way, and then see how that, you know, turns out. And then you can get so much texture, because there are hundreds of stitches, that, you know, I feel like we should loosen it up a bit. It shouldn't be so tight, and it could be a little bit more free. And like expressionism, really.
Even if it's just like every now and again, like a palate cleansing sorbet, you know, even if people just mix things up a little bit, get out of their comfort zone, even so that they just appreciate being back in their comfort zone.
Yeah, exactly. And just see it as, you know, I think impressionism is when you like, it's like a glance, isn't it? You know, so you might have seen a couple on the edge of a, you know, cliff or something. And you glanced it, and then you go away from it, and you draw it, and that's kind of impressionism. So it's never going to be accurate. It's just an impression of what you've seen, you know. And I quite like that as an idea for canvas work, where it's not sort of quite so fixed lines and hard edges. And you can achieve that because of different textured stitches you could use. So, yeah, I would like to do some more canvas work, really, myself.
Let's talk about your background then, because I know that you were a future tutor.
Yeah.
Does that work? Are you a future tutor, or have you been a present tutor? Were you a future tutor, but now that was in the past, so now you're a tutor?
I am. I graduated. So, okay. Yeah, I trained with the Royal School of Needlework on their future tutor course. I started on CND, which is their certificate and diploma, and then I went on and did their future tutor. And now I'm a tutor. And I work with them still, but I do a lot of things with other organisations as well, and also just for myself. So they're sort of one of my clients.
What brought you to them in the first place? What's your sort of, I mean, were you always a stitcher? Was it something you came to at a certain point in time?
No, yeah, I've always been a stitcher. I started really young. Most people say that their mothers, you know, influenced them in a positive way to stitch. I can't really say that so much. My mum was not a finisher. Okay. So she abandoned work by the side of the chair in a plastic bag in order to nurse a cat or something, and it never got finished, and so I finished all her projects for her, and that's really how I got into it. So I just finished her cast-offs. But I was stitching kits from probably about 6. I was really young, and I stitched every day because I didn't really like watching telly. I've always been, I like making, so I've always wanted to make. And I used to come in from school, and I used to do my homework straight away, and at 6 o'clock, there was a movie on BBC Two, wasn't there? A black and white movie, or Tarzan, or Charlie Chan, or Richard. You know, all those movies were on at 6, and they were about, yeah. I don't know, 7:30, which is when my dad came home for tea. And I would then, that was also my craft time, and I would stitch. Sitting on the sofa, I'd have a canvas on my lap, and I would, you know, stitch up masterpieces, Renoirs, Monets, you know, Fragonard, anything really. So that's how I sort of got into it, and I continued that throughout my schooling until I was really a young adult, and then I sort of, you know, started going out more, and I didn't go to university when I finished school, when I, you know, I was going out, and I started losing the interest a little bit in the stitching and doing lots of other art instead. So I was doing, you know, stone carving courses, ceramic, stained glass, etching. I mean, Brighton's great like that because I moved to Brighton in my 20s. And, you know, there were so many opportunities to do so many different arts, you know, I was dreadful at it, but I did like ceramic, ceramic sculpture. So we did that. I remember there was one, we had a life drawing. So we had the Armitage and we had to make, and there was this guy, he came in and all his, is it called a Prince Albert? Anyway, he was all pierced up. And I was trying my best to get the figure and to get the shape and everything and focusing, and the tutor did come around and she sort of said, I think you spent too much attention on his nether regions, as it's completely out of proportion to the rest of him.
Nice.
So there was just so much art there and that you could get involved in that I did. So I ended up getting a proper, proper job type thing and doing a lot of art. But actually, in my 20s, I did a lot of travelling. So that sort of kicked in. So I didn't go to uni. I went to Australia for a year instead. That was my university then. And travelled and, worked on a dive boat and just did anything really. Hitchhiked, all the things you shouldn't. It was the year of the backpacker murderers. I don't know what I was thinking. But anyway.
Brilliant.
Rang home. Oh, I'm just looking, Mum. But and then I came back and I sort of got little jobs, and then I went off travelling again, So I did do quite a bit of that in my 20s. And then I went to university when I was 28. So I went to Sussex and then I ended up in Brighton. So then I ended up settling there. So, but part of the reason I went to university was because I was very dyslexic when I was younger. So, I really wanted to sort of conquer it really, in some ways it held back my confidence. And I think that's probably why I was so interested in making and art, because I could do that, with some degree of ease. And get a real sense of fulfillment from it, whereas academic work at that point was not fulfilling. So it was, and that worked so well for me. It was hard, it was quite a challenge, and I got a lot of support, but it also just ignited my enjoyment of writing, really. And, it was quite a shame that I hadn't hadn't been sort of encouraged when I was younger. Traditional school didn't suit me at all. But actually, even the writing, I enjoy that creativity of, I'm just a fantasist, basically. I like going off on a... I was thinking that this morning, actually. I was thinking, because I really like Renaissance landscapes. And I was thinking that this morning, and I'm like... I think I'm a bit of a Renaissance fantasist because I've hit my Renaissance period of my life, and I'm sort of a bit of a fantasy, sort of sparkle in it as well.
I mean, your brand does involve the word cloud, which always makes it sound a bit fantastical as well, to be honest.
But yeah, I struggled with a little bit with a name because Juno is my middle name, and therefore I wanted to use I always used it as my art name when I was younger, because I was like, basically I could hide behind it if they didn't like it, they wouldn't know it's me, because most people don't know your middle name. So it was all fine. And then, lots of people remember it really easily. And Juno Embroidery was gone to a Japanese lady. And I don't really like it when you just get your name and then embroidery, Karen Smith. It's a bit sort of so it was supposed to be all my thoughts and ideas, and I suppose it was inspired by Apple Mac as well with their cloud idea, and it just sort of sat together, and I thought, well, actually that does work quite well, so it works for me. So that's where it comes
from. Very mystical. I like it, because I think what's nice is, again, it's pulling you up. It's like this heavenly thing, it's kind of like the work that you do may seem very grounded, the techniques that you provide and all of that, but you're operating on it from a cloud, so therefore entirely different perspective.
I guess so. And also, lots of thoughts does go into it. One of my favorite parts of a project is like the when you finish, I don't know if you get this, but you're sort of finishing a project, you're about three quarters of the way through, and you're bored of it because you're really getting towards the end and you've thought about it a lot, and your mind goes off. Well, my mind goes off to the next thing. I really can't wait to finish because I want to start the next one. And it's that period of planning, or not even planning, just sort of daydreaming that I really like. I love a daydream, and I live a lot in here, and you know, it's quite stimulating. So I like that period, and then I like the sort of choices, the deciding part. But I don't really plan. I mean, I'm dyslexic. Who plans when they're dyslexic? They just go with the flow, really. And so I am pretty organic, and I will change my mind along the way and let things grow and see how they interact together. And if I don't like it, I'll just take it out and do something else or start again. Yeah. So I'm not really a planner.
I'm always fascinated by that bit, because you're not the only person who said this, and I've had it myself, where there must be something at the back of your mind that knows that you're past the point of a project, like everything's going to be okay now. You know, you're somewhere unconsciously, you know that, because that's when the new idea starts to creep in around the corner, doesn't it? And it's like, there must be something there, you know it.
Yeah, it's like freewheeling down the hill, isn't it? You've done all the uphill bit, and now we're in the free wheel. Just the wind through my hair. Yeah. New idea can come in space.
And are you quite open to just letting the new ideas come in? From what you've said, you know, you don't plan it or whatever. If it's completely left field idea to the one you're currently having, are you at ease with that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I like that, really. You know, I kind of, you know, I don't have to have any rhyme or reason to my ideas at all. I mean, I like decorative arts for the pure fact that they are useless. I love that. You know, I don't want things. I like useless things. I always did as a kid, you know. My mum would buy me a watch or something. I was like, no, please just give me something useless. You know, so that's a, you know, great joy. It's a decorative piece. That is its use. Its use is to be beautiful in the world and to be, you know, have impact. I like impactful work. If it's a bit vanilla, then I'm not so keen. You know, even my stuff, it'll just go in a drawer. I'll be like, yeah, that's not pushing my boat, really, or floating my boat.
If there are any chocolate teapot manufacturers out there, let Chrissy know, because she definitely wants one of those.
Exactly. I think that's why my work, I suppose it is a bit eclectic. You know, I'm hoping as I grow a body of work, it might have some sort of cohesion. But life takes you in lots of different directions. So you can't really plan, can you, where your work's going to go? Because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, that's true.
Make you go, oh, I need to do that. So I don't know that.
So when you get a new idea, is it sort of a concept and then somewhere down the line the technique that you might use reveals itself? Because I guess what's great about you is you've got an arsenal, so you can, you know, use certain types of stitches to achieve certain outcomes quite easily.
When I did Ayana, the African girl's face, then I didn't want to do black work again. I don't want to do another black work piece, you know. So I went straight on to do, you know, I've been wanting to do actually a birthday box, which a friend of mine said, you can't call it a birthday box. It sounds rude. But anyway, it's a birthday box that I've done myself. So, you know, and that's all gold work and stump work and bright colours and, you know, all the things I like. It's like a sweetie tray of things that I like. So that is the antithesis of the black work, really. So I wanted to do that. So I guess that is quite nice. I have got that. You know, I won't necessarily do another gold work straight away. I might go on to something more wool-based or textured. So I can mix it up quite a lot. I do get bored easily, so I don't want to just do the same thing all the time. But again, you know, a piece might suggest itself and lend itself to something, and then I sort of go with the flow with that. Oh, I think often I do go, I like to do a canvas now. Okay, what am I going to do? You know, I think I do that.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.